Now we are going to think about design and distortion. We're beginning to think about God's story, creation and the fall. Where do we begin in God's purpose in creation? Well, in Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 and 28, we see that God creates humankind in his image. And it tells us that he created them male and female. In other words, God designed our bodies this way. God designed two sexes. That is a good thing, like everything in God's original creation. And he blesses human beings and he tells them to multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. He gives us a purpose. But male and female are different and complementary. So when we get to Genesis 2, we realize that God creates the man first from the earth, and then the man names all of the animals, but he cannot find a helper who is fit for him. In other words, a helper who is his equal. And so God creates the woman. And in other words, it's not good, it says, that the man should be alone. Why is it not good? Well, you could say God told them to go and multiply. A man cannot do that without a woman. Okay, so there is a biological reason. But it's not only that. What we are saying is that the man cannot rule well. He cannot subdue the earth. He cannot reflect the image and likeness of God fully without the woman. Okay, this is God's good design, that it takes both male and female to represent the fullness of the image of God. In creation, God has separated us into two sexes, male and female. But we need both of these working together to fulfill God's purpose. We are different and complementary. We are both necessary. Now, yes, I believe, and I realize not every Christian will see this the same way, but I believe the Bible says that because God created men first, there is also a responsibility for male headship. There is a difference in roles. But I realize, again, there will be different views on what that means. But whatever way we believe about that, we have to recognize that the differences between the sexes are by God's design. They are not things for us to ignore or deny, and they are not things for us to try and change, but for us to accept from God. And then when we get later in Genesis chapter 2, we discover that marriage is designed by God as a way of bringing back together what God separates in creation. Okay, he separates the woman out from the man when he makes Eve from Adam. They're separate, but when they are married, they come back together and become one flesh. And that principle, one flesh, yes, it applies to the physical activity of sexual activity, of sexual intercourse, but it's not only about that. It's also about the way that in marriage, the male and the female come together in partnership for God's purpose. That's what Christian marriage is about. It's what biblical marriage is about. But it's also, I've said, a parable of God's love. When we come to Ephesians 5, the Apostle Paul quotes from Genesis, and he says this is a profound mystery. And I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. Notice that. Why did God design two sexes? And why did he design marriage to be between a man and a woman? Is it because God just likes making up rules and differences? Or is it oppressive? That's what the serpent says in chapter 3. Did God really say, God is just trying to spoil life for you? No, God created it because it is good. And God created it that way because it teaches us something about God and God's love. In your experience as a person, where do you learn about love? Well, the first place you learn love is, of course, from your parents. If they are good parents, loving parents, it's not always true, but if they are, you learn an unconditional love. Your parents didn't choose you. They chose to try and have children, but they didn't choose the child that they got. Okay? So parental love is unconditional. And of course, God's love in creation is like that. It is parental love. He creates us and he loves us because he created us. But the second way that you learn about the nature of love, if you have loving parents who love each other, is by observing their marriage, observing the way they love each other, even though they are different. Observing how they learn to appreciate the differences between them each other, learn, and how, yes, sometimes there might be conflict, but how they work that through and how their covenant commitment holds them together. God designed marriage as a way of teaching children about his love. Because the love of God in creation might be like the love of parents, but the love of God in salvation is like the love of a husband for his wife, Paul says, that God has chosen a people. Marriage love is chosen, whether it's chosen by the individual or by the family in an arranged marriage, it's chosen. These people weren't born together, they have to learn to love each other. And God's love in salvation is chosen. And marriage is a parable that points us to it. I think that's why the evil one, the enemy, Satan, wants to destroy parenting and marriage. It's why abortion, which turns parental love into chosen love, is so destructive to young people, not only the ones who are killed in abortion, but also to the ones who survive. Because the parents cannot say, I love you unconditionally, I chose you because you came at the right time and you had the right qualities. And it's true as well that Satan will then attack marriage and sex between a man and a woman and the connection between marriage and sex, which was separated in the sexual revolution, because this is where we learn about the love of God. A love which is not love for someone that is like me, but for someone who is different from me, for the opposite, for the other, like God's love for us. God's good design for sex is there in our biology. And we were talking about this earlier, but you can look at bodies and you can see that male bodies tend to look different from female bodies. That's, of course, more obvious with a naked body. There are different bits, but it's also the shape of our bodies, the size. Yes, there are different female bodies of different sizes and shapes and male bodies, but there are also differences between the sexes. And why are there differences? Because there are hormonal differences, different sex hormones. And those hormones are produced in different gonads, ovaries, and testes. And those gonads also produce different gametes, egg cells, and sperm cells. And we have different chromosomes. The Y chromosome gives rise to male development. If you don't have a Y chromosome, the body develops as a female. In other words, there are two types. So the argument that sex, biological sex, is a social construct does not fit the science. In science, there are two types of normal bodies. There are two types of sex chromosomes, two types of gonads, two types of gametes, two hormones, two types of bodies, and two types of brains. Now, please. This becomes a generalization. It's not saying that all women think one way and all men think one way, but when you scan the brains of women, you find that they have tend to have more connections across the brain, and for men, they tend to have more connections from the front to the back of the brain. And that explains what we said at the very beginning, why it is that girls tend to choose to play with dolls. Because the connections in their brains wire them for compassion. Some people say empathy. I don't think empathy is the right word, but to have compassion for other people. That's the primary wiring of most female brains, most women's brains. But the primary wiring of most boys' brains is for structure and systems and cars, of course. Well, they move, and that's better for most boys. Now, again, these are generalities, both the shape of the body and the function of the brain, and also the roles, the preferences. It's not saying that if a boy prefers dolls, that he has a female brain in a male body, because the brain is part of the body. So we can't talk about male brains and female brains in male and female bodies. But what we can say is that there are two normal patterns of development. We are different, and this reflects what the Bible says, that God has created us different. And just to say that Simon Baron Cohen, who's a professor in Cambridge University in England, is one of the leading writers on this. He's a cousin, if you're interested, of the actor and comedian Sacha Baron Cohen. But he went a different route in life. He says the female brain is predominantly hardwired for empathy, the typical male brain for understanding and building systems. And studies show that all around the world, women are better empathizers than men in all cultures, and all across the world, whether they have equality of opportunity or not, you tend to get more boys and men who will go into engineering, and those kinds of subjects, even if girls have equal opportunity to do it. That doesn't mean that a female engineer is wrong or bad. It just means that there is a difference between most male brains and most female brains. But we live in a fallen world. We don't live in the world as God originally created it. We have had many generations of the effects of sin and of the curse on our world. And that has affected our relationships. We have tension between the sexes. We see that in Genesis chapter 3. God says to the woman, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. When it says your desire, that could mean that she will have an unhealthy desire to be ruled over, or that she will have an unhealthy desire to rule over him. But either way, it's not healthy. It's conflict. And we see that. It didn't start with the feminist movement. It was there from the Garden of Eden. We have a problem in society. We don't have positive role models of male and female. We have distorted stereotypes of masculinity and femininity that confuse us and that make some people think they don't fit. I'm not a normal boy or girl. These are not healthy. The typical female body is meant to what, look like a Barbie doll? Of course not. That is just not healthy. We have problems with bodies. We need to recognize some bodies don't develop as the normal pattern. Anne Fausto Sterling said in 2000 that 1.7% of people are intersex. That's the label that she created, that phrase. But actually, that is wrong. When we look at the development of the body, things can go wrong, and I won't go into each of these, but they can go wrong with the chromosomes, they can go wrong with the gonads, they can go wrong with the hormones, they can go wrong with the external genitalia. But actually, most of these, it is very clear whether it is a male or a female. You can either look at the genes and see that, or you can see that the body hasn't developed exactly right, but it is a male body or a female body with some problems. And what Fausto Sterling has done there is to group together many different things which are disorders of sex development, but where the vast majority are clearly male or female. There is a much smaller percentage, and Leonard Sachs says this in response to Sterling or Fausto Sterling, that actually, if you define intersex as being not clearly male or female, or that the body mismatches what the chromosomes, the genes are, then the percentage is only 0.018%. So these problems do exist, but they are very rare. I still would say I don't think the term intersex is helpful, because it suggests that this person is something between two things, when actually this is a precious person and we need to work for their body to figure out is it better for them to live as a man or as a woman. But this is very rare and it is not a separate category. There has never been in the history of science someone who has fully functioning ovaries and fully functioning testes in the same body. That doesn't exist. They might have some cells from ovaries and some from testes, but there has never been someone who is both fully male and female. Things go wrong with bodies in a fallen world, with sexual development, as with every part of the body. And of course, things can go wrong with our emotions. We can have gender dysphoria and fixed same-sex attraction. I think it is helpful when we use the phrase transgender to recognize that it's an umbrella term for different experiences. And Preston Sprinkle separates those out like this. He says, there is early onset gender dysphoria. We were talking about this earlier in the Q&A session. This tends to happen very early in life, before puberty. It's more common in male than in female. It doesn't seem to be chosen. The cause is not clear. It can either be constant or intermittent. It can have variable severity. Some people feel it very strongly. But notice this, the majority do not feel that way any longer after puberty. Perhaps 60%, perhaps even 85% will no longer feel that way after they pass puberty. So we should not affirm that in children, although increasingly doctors will do that. And certainly we're being told in education to affirm it. We should help and support this child to move through that. But then there are some adults who identify as transgender and they don't have any gender dysphoria. They are not distressed. They don't feel distress at being in the wrong body. It seems that they choose it. So they believe the queer theory idea, I am free to choose. And there may be drivers. Autogynephilia is being sexually aroused by the thought of yourself as a person of the opposite sex. Or internal homophobia, that you don't like the idea of homosexuality, but you're attracted to the opposite sex, so that you start to identify as the opposite sex from your real sex, or you're attracted to the same sex, so you start to identify as the opposite sex, so that you don't have to think of yourself as homosexual. Or perhaps an internal misogyny for girls, that they think negatively about women, so they don't want to be a woman anymore, they want to be a man. Or for women. But this is in adults, and it does seem to be chosen. It's not the same as early onset gender dysphoria. And then there is this middle category, which is controversial. It's been proposed by Lisa Littman in 2017, because she was observing that there has been a very large increase in teenagers reporting that they are transgender and experiencing gender dysphoria. And this seems to develop after puberty. It's more common, unlike the early onset, which is more common in boys. And that might be because of the connection with autism, that boys are more likely to be autistic. There is some connection for some people, at least. But this one is more common in girls than in boys. And Lisa Littman argues that this is a social contagion. They are getting this idea from social media and from magazines and so on. But activists say, no, that's wrong. These are just people who are transgender, who are discovering it later because we have a freer society. What is not clear, because this is quite new, is what will happen to these people over time. I think Littman must be right. I do think there must be a social element, because the rate of increase, I don't think can be explained by the science. But like I say, the activist would say, I am being transphobic even by saying that. So we live in this fallen world. And in this world, of course, there are different responses to transgender. We could have a psychological approach, talking therapies to reduce the dysphoria. But activists say that's transphobic. So increasingly, that is not favored. We could have social transition, using my preferred pronouns and changing my gender or sex legally. That is allowed in law now. But of course, that affects everyone, especially women and children. Are we going to say that children can choose to have a different name and pronoun? What about safe spaces for women? So some feminists argue against that. We can use puberty blockers to prevent puberty starting in children. But the problem is they have side effects. It used to be said they're harmless, they can be reversed. That is not true. They are not fully reversible. They harm development. And yet they are used, particularly in America, not so much, at least in Britain. I'm not sure about other European countries. We can give them the hormones of the opposite sex. We can change their body by doing that. but that's not fully effective. It's more effective for women. It's easier to make a female body look and sound like a male body. It's not so easy for a male body, especially if you look at the hands. The bone structure tends to be different. So it's not convincing. And we could do surgery, sex reassignment, or increasingly the activists will say gender affirming surgery. We can fashion the appearance of a body of the identified sex. But notice the way I've put that. The reality is that you cannot, it is not ultimately true because the genes of that body will still be either male or female. All that you are doing is creating an appearance. And to do that, you are damaging a healthy body. And I have a problem with that as a medic. Ethically, I think that is wrong. But of course, some doctors will do it because they think it will help the person psychologically. It's also very, very costly. And it raises the big question that many of those people later might regret it. You might ask, well, what about causes and consequences? Well, we talked about that earlier in the Q&A. The causes of same-sex attraction and gender dysphoria are unclear. This review article from 2016 is very helpful in pulling that together. Born this way is not supported by science. People identifying as homosexual and transgender experience higher rates of anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and suicide. But the activist will say that's because society is oppressing them. And certainly social stigma may play a part. I think that makes sense. It will make people feel worse if they face opposition. But the evidence is that it's not the only part, or not necessarily even the main part. It seems that even when society is accepting, people in these categories have more problems with their mental health. And after sex reassignment surgery, so-called, increased rates of mental health issues at an increased risk of suicide persist. This is one of the very big questions that has not been properly researched yet. What happens afterwards? After the initial positivity about getting the surgery, which is natural, I mean, you have achieved a goal. If you have a goal in life and you achieve it, you will feel better for a short time. But what happens later? We're starting to see more stories of people who want to detransition, to change their body back. And tragically, it can't always be done, not completely. People who say, you shouldn't have given me those hormones, but we are not researching it properly because the campaign groups won't allow that. So we need better research, and maybe someone on this call could be part of that to find out what really happens. But we have to recognize in a fallen world, for some people, these are very real experiences. But of course, underlying that are beliefs and ideologies and values that are false. And that's what we'll come to in the next section.